Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Yale Club Silicon Valley program. As noted, my name is Pete Warden. I'm the chief bureaucrat here at NASA Ames. It's really my pleasure tonight to introduce Dr. Lynn Rothschild, research scientist at NASA Ames Research Center, and Father George Coyne, astronomer and director emeritus of the Vatican Observatory. Dr. Rothschild is an evolutionary biologist, astrophysicist at NASA Ames Research Center, and professor at Stanford and Brown Universities, teaching astrobiology and space exploration. She received her undergraduate degree in biology from Yale University. And an MA in zoology from Indiana University, and I was a Michigan grad. And a PhD in molecular and cellular biology from Brown University. Since arriving at NASA Ames in 1987, Dr. Rothschild's research has focused on how life, particularly microbes, have evolved in the context of the physical environment, both here and potentially elsewhere. Dr. Rothschild has appeared on National Geographic's Naked Science and co-edited a book, Evolution of Planet Earth, The Impact of the Physical Environment. Now, Father Coyne graduated from Fordham University with a degree in mathematics and a licentiate in philosophy. He later attended Georgetown University, where he earned his doctorate in astronomy. As a member of the Society of Jesus, he received a licentiate from Woodstock College in Sacred Theology and was ordained as a Roman Catholic priest in 1965. He joined the Vatican Observatory, based at the University of Arizona in Tucson in 1969, and was appointed director of the observatory in 1978 by Pope John Paul I, a position he held until 2006. Father Coyne has the rare distinction of having an asteroid named after him, asteroid 14429 Coyne. Now, he also has an even rarer distinction of having served in my dissertation committee at the University of Arizona. And we didn't tell him what we called him, but I will now. He knows this, but when I was a graduate student, we had names for everybody. For example, the department chairman was called Whizbang for his lectures, and George was called Father Photon. So I apologize in advance. I'd also like to take this opportunity to announce that that NASA Ames is sponsoring on March 12th, probably at the Mountain View Center for Performing Arts, Professor James Strick, a talk on Darwin and the Origin of Life. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Rothschild and Father Coyne.
I'm not sure I know whom you're applauding for. Is that good English? Whom you're applauding for? We'll see whether you applaud at the end. Thank you, Pete, for the introduction. You were very nice. There are a lot of other things you could have said. It reminded me when he said an asteroid was named for me. I'm really not sure I know what an asteroid is. I've certainly never studied them. I do know that naming objects like that, there are about 26 features on the moon that are named for Jesuit scientists, Clavius Riccioli, because there was a great tradition of Jesuits studying the moon in the 16th, 17th century. People ask me often, how many Jesuits are on the moon? And I say, as best I know, there are 26. There are about 226 we'd like to send there, but we can't get permission. Let's get more serious, and I'll get going ahead. What I'd like to talk to you about is to kind of set the scene for, I think, what Lynn will fold into, and we've talked a little bit how to coordinate this, that as an astronomer with a cosmology background, I would like to talk about the universe as a whole being fertile. And I'd like to explain... Let me go back one moment. What I mean by fertile universe, because that will fold into, is there life elsewhere in this fertile universe? You may think, well, if the universe is fertile, You know, why should life be limited to this little grain of sand we call the earth? So I'd like to talk about what I mean by the fertile universe. There are two ingredients to the fertility. One is the age of the universe, and one is the number of stars in the universe. Those two ingredients make it fertile. The age of the universe is 13.7 billion years, and we know that quite well. The problem is, I'm only 125 years old. I'm out to beat Moses, but I'm not all right. Well, who knows? But I don't have any sense of what 14, let's call it 14 billion, means. I have no experience of it, and I'm sure you don't, regardless of your age. So let's do what mathematicians do all the time, scale down a big number to a smaller number so we can get a feeling for it. So let's make out that the universe, instead of 14 billion years, is 1 year old. What do we see in that 1 year old universe? Well, it all began, of course, on January 1. First life came to be on the Earth on 4 September. The dinosaurs had the good fortune to be born on Christmas Day, but they only lived 5 days. But the most dramatic thing, I think, I consider it dramatic, is the last day of this 1-year-old universe. The first human beings came to be 2 minutes before midnight, before now. Jesus Christ was born 2 seconds ago, before now, and Galileo 1 second ago. Now, the point is, the age of the universe is so large with respect to any experience we have or any history we have that this is what happens when we make it comprehensible to us, bring it down to a year. Well, you could draw any number of conclusions that you want. I mean, a few that I have to suggest are that I have never met, and including to Pete Warden, I've never met a humble or modest astronomer or scientist. But we should be. We're studying a universe that's a year old, and we've been doing it for 1 second, if you would accept that modern science began with Galileo. Take it back a few centuries before Galileo and add a few milliseconds to this. The point is, we've been studying a universe that's a year old. With modern science, we've been doing it for 1 second. So if we don't know everything, give us a bit more time. The other is all of our religious traditions. I mean, I take the birth of Jesus as a central figure in religious history. You could put Buddha, Mohammed, anybody else on here you wanted. The point is, okay, all of our religious traditions, everything that I believe and hold dear, okay, all of Scripture, all of church traditions, church history, okay, God, if I believe that, and I do, has been speaking to me and to us in the churches for 2 seconds. So if we begin to ask questions, there's intelligent life out there, what would God have said to them? I tell people, first of all, intelligent life out there, we have no evidence for or against, and we're going to discuss that this evening some. But if there is intelligent life, and if God did speak to them, I don't have the slightest idea. I haven't absorbed what God has said to us in the last 2 seconds. They're the only things I like to say. The important thing about the age of the universe is it's very old in relative standards to us. And if it were not old, we would not be here. And that's a message I want to share as we go along. We could not have life in a young universe. The second ingredient of this fertility is that the universe has in it 10 to the 22nd stars. That's one with 22 zeros behind it for the non-scientist stars. How do we know that? Well, from the Big Bang up until today, 14 billion years. The universe has been getting bigger, so this is a cross-section of the universe. And as we look back in time, we see more distant objects. So let's do that with Hubble Space Telescope. Let's look back to about 2 billion years after the Big Bang, and what do we see? Well, it's not very impressive, really. It's a lot of bunches of light here. Hubble Space Telescope spent 40 orbits looking at a piece of the sky that approximately is about the thickness of a human hair, for those who have it. And it did that in order to go through all the nearby objects, stars and galaxies that are nearby, in order to see as deep as it could into the universe, to the very distance. So on this slide, I can count only about 3 stars. The rest are all galaxies. And each of those galaxies contains, on the average, 100 billion stars, like our galaxy does. So if you have 100 billion galaxies, each with 100 billion stars, that gives you 10 to the 22nd stars in the universe. Well, if you don't believe me, let's look at a few of these objects. There's an irregular galaxy. There's a spiral galaxy, which, by the way, just curious, is eating up a little baby galaxy. We call it galactic cannibalism. Isn't it a nice word? Actually happens. And here, down here, is a nice spiral galaxy like our own. Well, we could talk about the structure of galaxies. The point is, this is just a little piece of the universe, and every object on here, essentially, is a galaxy. And there are galaxies, many of them, that are at 12 billion light years away, so only 2 billion years after the Big Bang. Now, I call that a fertile universe, but only fertile if you'll follow me for another moment. This is one of those galaxies that is shown in detail. It measures 100,000 light years across, pardon me, and it contains, as I said, 100 billion stars. If we look inside this galaxy, our galaxy, by the way, is very similar to this. This is the Andromeda galaxy, a sister galaxy to our own. If we look inside, we find many of these gas clouds, incandescent gas. If we look, Hubble looked at this in detail and was able to see that little pieces of this gas were beginning to break off and condense. Sorry about this. I'm hitting the wrong buttons all the time here. These pieces of gas begin to condense. As they condense, as a gas condenses, it heats up. As it expands, it cools down. Laws of gas physics. In this case, this piece of gas contains several times the mass of the sun. So when it collapses, it heats the interior to millions of degrees and starts a thermonuclear furnace. Very well understood in physics, right? The conversion of hydrogen to helium, helium to carbon to nitrogen. Each time this furnace converts hydrogen to helium, energy is released. And then when that process has terminated in a star, if a star has enough mass, it condenses again to raise the temperature even higher to start converting helium to carbon, and then eventually carbon to nitrogen. Depending on the mass of the star, it will go all the way up the periodic table to iron. Notice that what is happening through the birth of stars and the death of stars, these are dying stars. That is a white dwarf that at the end of its life, when it condensed a final time, it could not raise the temperature high enough to turn on the next thermonuclear furnace. It had no energy source, so it collapsed a final time, and by a rebound, it threw out its outer atmosphere to the universe. Other stars do this more violently, like this Crab Nebula. This was a star that when it died, it contained something like 5 times the mass of the sun. So it didn't die that kind of peaceful death. It died an agonizing death. But the essential thing is it threw all of this matter out to the universe. From this gas, another generation of stars are going to be born. So what's happening with the birth and death of stars is very critical to this fertile universe I'm talking about. What is happening is the universe is being supplied with heavier elements all the time. First generation of stars born of pure hydrogen. Second generation of stars, there's some helium, some carbon. Third generation of stars, and the sun is a third generation star. We have enough heavier elements to make life. We have the chemical abundances for life. And that's what I mean by the fertile universe. Just that. An old universe had to be old in order to get three generations of stars. The sun is 5 billion years old, approximately. It will be around for another 5 billion. Okay, there's sure time enough for those of you who need to go to confession and all that stuff. What's going to happen? My faith always keeps, you know, I carry it on my collar here. What's going to happen, okay, is that the universe is getting constantly replenished with heavier material, and it took 12 billion years before an amoeba could come to be. Our earlier, younger universe could not supply the chemistry for life. So that's why I say we could not come to be in a young universe, relatively speaking. It had to be about as old as it is. Okay? So we are born of stardust. That's literally true. All right? I have professor friends at the University of Arizona say we're born of thermonuclear waste, but it's... It's the same reality. Okay, I'm closing in on around at least one of these stars. This happened. A planetary system came to be, and that did not happen by a miracle, but by ordinary physical processes. And so this little grain of sand came to be. And on that grain of sand, we developed the capacity to put the universe in our heads. This is a marvelous thing, I think. Not even we scientists many times appreciate that through physics, biology, chemistry, mathematics, we put the universe in our heads. The universe is no longer in blind evolution, blind expansion. In us, at least, it's thinking about itself. We can study it. And when we study it, we get all kinds of questions like, where did we come from? And now I'm going to spit it out and then leave it to Lynn to try and undo it or do it as she sees fit. We came to be, after the chemistry was enough and all, through a process of what is said neo-Darwinian evolution, okay? The development of species, keep hitting the wrong button here, until we got the human brain. How did that happen? Well, I'm giving a very summary presentation of this. Lynn is going to enter into it. We happened like, this is what happened. Now, I don't know enough chemistry to be able to tell you what this is all about. What I do know, and you can know if you can look at this enough, to see that H, C, N, and O repeat themselves time and time again, hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. But they continue to repeat themselves in ever more complex molecules, right? Till you get to the amino acids, the sugars, the proteins, DNA. The human brain. If you allow this process to go on for 14 billion years, okay, with this chemistry being supplied all the time, without going into detail, because I cannot, and there are lots of, you know, sort of criticisms of this process, but essentially it's the best scientific explanation we have of how the human brain came to be. It's called chemical complexity in a universe that's very fertile. This is always interesting to me. If you measure the two most simple things you can measure about anything in the universe, how big is it, R, and how much does it weigh, speaking loosely, M, you put it on this plot. And all living things fit in to this relationship. If this is true for the whole universe, does that say anything about is there life elsewhere in the universe? It sure makes me curious if this holds for all these objects. So the question, are there the conditions for life elsewhere in the universe? I don't know. All I've been able to supply as a cosmologist is what I call this kind of gross fertility of the universe. Some will say if you have the chemistry, you necessarily have life. Some will say, no, why should you necessarily have life? And Lynn, maybe you can do better with that question than I can. And of course, then, is there life elsewhere, if there are conditions for life? The only thing I like to say about this, if we find all the conditions for life elsewhere, does that mean there's life? We have all the conditions for life here on the Earth because we're here. But we do not yet know the jump from the conditions for life to life itself. We simply do not know the origins of life under our feet. So how are we going to jump from the conditions for life elsewhere to life itself until we find life itself? Well, I'd like to close with a little bang here. We actually have aliens in the Vatican. These are meteorites. We have a great meteorite collection in the Vatican, and Brother Guy Consolmagno dedicates his life to studying them and looking for extra solar chemistry, extraterrestrial chemistry for sure, in these meteorites. And a lot of information can be gained. I'm going to let Lynn, I just put this here. We look in our own solar system, and of course NASA and others are looking carefully at various objects in our own solar system. As best I know, and someone who knows more than I do about this, we have not yet discovered adequate conditions for life in our own solar system. Okay, liquid water maybe here, there, and things like that. But I think the questions are very open within our own solar system. Are there other planetary systems? And what have they taught us about ourselves? Well, yes, there are. We have discovered more than 200 planets around stars other than the sun. They're lined up here. I'm not going to go into detail. Most of them are massive planets like Jupiter because they're the only planets we can discover thus far. Okay? If we discover another planet, we have to consider about habitable zones around planets, around stars. The sun has this habitable zone. This habitable zone is defined, without going into detail, by very fundamental characteristics: temperature conditions, liquid water, water freezes, etc. The very fundamental conditions you need for life. If the star is half the mass of the sun, the habitable zone shrinks. If it's even less massive, it shrinks more. So I think the search for extraterrestrial life will use solar planets and solar-like planets, but only over a certain mass range, because the probability of finding life goes down, okay, as the habitable zone decreases. Is Earth unusual? Well, thus far it is. Is it unusual in an absolute sense? I think the answer is we don't know. And I can't resist the God question. Who did it? I don't know. And if the one who did it, why would that one who did it limit life to this little grain of sand? And that answer, I don't know. Because I don't know. I can't tell God what he can or cannot do as to limiting life or not. I think those kinds of questions are extremely tendentious and don't do anything good either for science or for religious faith. Well, thank you for listening. I'll let Lynn pick up from there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, George. I'm glad that we've got 5 billion years more for confession, because I'll just start right now and say I really hate to go right after you. Bula Bula. Are we getting the slides up here? Can we get the slides up? Okay, there we go. I'll just start with the guide question right there. Maybe I should also end it right there. What I'm going to do is touch on very similar subjects to what Father Coyne did, except take it from the opposite perspective, from the point of view of a biologist, and hopefully meet or not meet somewhere in the middle. I'm maybe going to be a little bit more of a downer, because I'm going to talk a little bit about circumscribing the envelope for life. So picking up where Father Coyne so nicely left off in the beginning, there was the Big Bang. The Big Bang created God, nature, and the rest of the universe. A couple of generations of stars later, there was a planet that was fortunate enough to have life. But unfortunately, we didn't know a lot of this. We thought that the universe was in the realm of the gods up till fairly recently. The Copernican Revolution put the natural world into the realm of science, out of the realm of the supernatural, into the realm of the knowable. And for this, we thank not just Copernicus, but Galileo, and as a biologist, I have to say, and all those guys, Newton, you know, Bruno, all the guys that got burned to the stake, and so on and so forth. But then we went through this period that was sort of a schizophrenic period, where we had the physical world within the realm of what we now call science. But oddly enough, the biological world wasn't. And, of course, last week we celebrated Darwin's 200th birthday, and it was thanks to Darwin that we were able to take this biological world and also put that within the realm of science. And I can't help but mention that there is still, of course, problems with some people's view of what Darwin actually said. Darwin, in essence, showed a mechanism that was capable of producing the evolutionary diversity that we see. The whole idea of change was already in the air. Of course, his grandfather, Erasmus, most famously wrote Zoonomia, which suggested there had been change. Lamarck, a whole series of people had. But there was no mechanism for it. And what Darwin's great contribution was natural selection, an incredibly seductive mechanism, because it was so very simple and it led so naturally from artificial breeding, from domestication of birds and dogs and so on. But at the same time, this is a mechanism that has no room necessarily for a guiding principle, for a God figure, and so it remains something that troubles many people today. On the other hand, there are people who then take this mechanism of natural selection and use that as a template, perhaps, for ethics and morals. And so I'll just throw that out there, and maybe you want to play with that later, George. But I should say that without that, we would not be able to understand AIDS. We would not be able to understand biology today. We would be able to understand nothing in the living world without this mechanism. But the revolutions didn't stop there. As what I like to say is the last great revolution is the astrobiology revolution, and ground zero really is right here at Ames Research Center for the astrobiology revolution. And what it did is take the Darwinian revolution and move one step farther off planet Earth to ask questions: are we alone in the universe? Where did we come from in a very broad sense, all the way back from the Big Bang? Because as Father Coyne pointed out, we didn't even have the elements there from which we could build life till there had been several generations of stars. So where did life come from? Where is it going? Because we're still evolving. We're still in a solar system that's changing. Our sun continues to burn. It will someday go supernova unless we can find some bank willing to bail us out. Or, you know, it's going to take a lot more than the $1 trillion, you know, bailout. But there, I will say parenthetically that I gave a talk on losing the moon at Ames about a dozen years ago or so. And during the interval, one of the investment bankers who was in the audience asked me confidentially, you know, should we be starting a hedge fund? And I suppose, you know, looking back at what's happened to the banking industry, I probably should have said yes at the time. Anyway, what we're going to do is focus on this middle question: are we alone? And so what I'd like to do is focus a little bit on what the limits of life might be in this fertile universe and what its implications might be. So let's start back with this cosmos and ask, what do we really need for life? And so then from that, we can start to map what the limits to life might be and on Earth, and therefore, would it possibly happen elsewhere? So what do we need for life? I think probably most of you are familiar with these sorts of arguments. What we need are certain elements in the periodic table. We most assuredly need carbon. We think this because it's the most versatile element, in spite of what you may have seen in sci-fi movies about nitrogen or silicon-based life. Some people even say that silicon-based life will ultimately take over from human life, from our carbon-based life. But I did come to the realization a week or so ago that I'm a good deal older than my computer, and I fully intend to outlive it. So that can give you some idea of what, you know, how much silicon-based life is worth. So I would argue that we certainly need carbon. We have some very fine astrochemists at Ames, some in the audience, who have shown that this carbon-based chemistry is really the language of the universe. So I feel very comfortable sitting on this silicate rock, yet made of carbon, to argue that life anywhere in our universe is going to be based on carbon. It also needs hydrogen, not a problem. There's tons of this in the universe. Then we want to get some oxygen in here, and nitrogen, of course, phosphorus and sulfur is always nice. It would be, you know, jolly nice to throw in some magnesium and a few other things, but probably we're okay with that carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur for a start. So these are what we call the biogenic elements. From there, we need some sort of solvent so that the chemistry can work. The solvent that we use, of course, is water. That doesn't mean that there couldn't be other solvents. On Titan, we find liquid methane. Perhaps that would be a good solvent. Certainly, my chemist friends tell me that there are organic solvents that would be actually much better for creating interesting chemistry than water. But we've been following the water approach at NASA for a while now, and it's a reasonably good first argument. There's certainly plenty of water in the universe. Beyond that, we need some sort of source of energy. Our sun provides a nice source. There are geothermal sources. There are radioactive sources. There are all sorts of other potential sources. So this doesn't seem to be a showstopper, particularly since you need some place to live. So presumably you're going to be somewhere near something like a star. And the final thing is that you need time. Now, people always say, well, yes, and we need time. And you're supposed to sort of faint backwards and think of millions and millions of years. Where do these numbers come from? From what I can tell, out of thin air. We have no idea how long it takes for life to arise. We know that life is incredibly complex. All life is complex. We're not complex, and then there's simple microbes out there. Life, by definition, is very complex. So we have this feeling that it must take an enormous amount of time, but we don't know. So I say to my students every year, it may turn out that this is something very simple, sort of a terrarium sort of situation where all we needed to do is add one more pinch of nitrate or something and the whole system would get going. And next year we're going to give you test tubes on Thursday and ask you to bring in life on Monday to serve as a weekend assignment. I don't know. I don't carry malpractice insurance. This could be in the newspapers tomorrow. Don't come demand your money back. I can't promise. On the other hand, this may never occur within our lifetimes. We don't know, and this is the great unanswered mystery in biology. We have very, very good evolutionary theory to explain what happens when you go from a prokaryote to a eukaryote, from a single cell to a multicellular organism, from multicells to plants to animals to fungi to dinosaurs to humans. We have so many intermediate steps and stages and evolutionary pressures and so on and so forth, a lot of experimental and fossil data and so on. What we are missing is this big gap going from inanimate objects, from organic chemistry to a living organism, and I can't stress that enough. So is this enough when we're searching for life to know that, well, we need these biogenic elements, we need a solvent, we need some time, but we have no idea how long, and some energy? Well, I think that that's not actually enough, because what's missing is something that's at the foundation of most of the sciences, and that is to look for laws, because the laws are what give us predictive power. And I know that there are many philosophers of science who sort of dismiss biology, and particularly evolutionary biology. They don't have laws. It's not like gravity. I can take this and drop it, and we know pretty much what's going to happen. I don't think there's any question out in the audience. But if we take a population of organisms and say, what's going to happen to them in 10,000 years, we don't have the same sort of law-like system. We can give them evolutionary pressures and get some idea of what direction the population's going to go. For example, we know that mammals, organisms that have to be warm-blooded, as they get towards the poles, tend to get larger as a way to decrease their surface area to volume ratio. It keeps them warmer. For the same reason, limbs tend to get shorter. So you don't see giraffes on the North Pole, and vice versa. You don't see polar bears at the equator. Makes a lot of sense. So this is it's not a law in the same sense as gravity, but it's certainly a very strong trend that would give us some predictive power. And so that's the sort of thing that we're going to look for. And what I'm going to argue is that since life on Earth is based on organic carbon, but worse, most of the carbon in the universe is inorganic. In other words, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, or just plain elemental carbon, and on top of it, that life is lazy. In other words, you don't do anything you don't have to. If you come home and your mom's made dinner, you don't ignore it and make your own dinner. You say thank you and you eat it. Life is like that. We don't do things we don't have to do because then we can save the energy for something else. And that something else in evolution is reproduction, of course, passing on our genes and so on. So we've got the fact that we're based on organic carbon. Most of the carbon is inorganic. Life doesn't do anything it doesn't have to. Evolution uses what's available, and contingency, as Stephen Jay Gould used to point out, does occur. I mean, there is the odd asteroid that wipes out the dinosaurs. It's a bad luck day. The worst hair day in the history of the life on Earth, well, it wasn't even life, was 50 million years after the Earth formed. We were hit by a rogue planet, and that's what ended up forming the moon. I mean, that was a terrible day. Thank goodness none of us were around. Things happen. Okay? So we can't discount that. So if we follow all those arguments, what I'm going to argue is that any place that we find life elsewhere in the universe, we're going to see a similar pattern in a broad sense to what we see in life on Earth. That is that we first have organisms taking advantage of whatever organic carbon is around them. And we know that there are organic carbon compounds, sugars and so on, that rain in on meteorites that are formed endogenously in planets and so on. So life's going to take advantage of those. But at some point, that's going to become limiting. So the smart organism says, all right, I'll make my own. And thus you have the origin of autotrophy, for example, photosynthesis. Now, life is lazy. So the next organism comes along and says, well, someone else is making their own dinner. Why don't I just eat it? And there you've got the herbivores. So there's the origin of vegetarians out there. Now, vegetables are nice. We sent our kids home tonight actually instructing them to eat some vegetables. That's good. Vegetables are good for you. But to be honest, you get a lot more energy out of meat. So the clever organism says, you know what? I'll eat the vegetarian. And so you have this whole chain that makes perfect sense, starting with simple premise that life is based on organic carbon, and most of the carbon around is not organic. So I'm arguing that those steps in a broad outline would occur elsewhere as they have over and over and over on the Earth. So what are the limits to life? Well, we can start to look at the physical and chemical environment and say, well, it's not just that there's, water and organic molecules. There's certain environmental limits for life. And so what I'm doing is showing this nice picture of a hot spring in Kenya in the Rift Valley, Lake Bogoria, just as a way to illustrate some of these environmental extremes. The most obvious one that's very easy to explain is temperature. Now, we're based on using water. We need liquid water. All life on Earth needs liquid water. And so you would imagine that would mean we would have to live between 0 and 100 degrees Celsius. But yet there are organisms that are able to beat the odds. They literally produce antifreeze. And so they're able to go well down below zero and still maintain metabolic activity. Now, this may seem astounding, And if it does seem astounding to you, you've got your brain compartmentalized tonight, because most of us are aware of organisms that can live well below zero and stay perfectly active. I point out penguins are a perfect example. But people tell me, oh, but you know, penguins, they cheat. They have feathers. Well, you know what, gang? Feathers count. The point is that there are organisms that can beat these odds and live well below zero. Now, on the other extreme, we're all aware of the fact that if you take an egg and you crack it into a pan that's hot, it's going to fry. And once it fries, you're not going to be able to unfry it. Again, if there's anyone here who knows how to unfry an egg, please come see us afterwards. I'm sure, I speak for Pete, that NASA would be extremely interested in this machine. The fact is that once we denature proteins and lipids and so on, we can't put them back together. So you would think, okay, there's a hard upper limit to life. And perhaps there is, but we haven't found it yet. We have found organisms that live up to 90, 100 degrees Celsius, 110, 121 right now is the best verified upper estimate. I mean, this is grossly above the boiling temperature of water. So right now, we're looking at limits for life in the temperature range of roughly minus 20 Celsius to 120 Celsius. An enormous range, but not an infinite range, and that in itself eliminates a lot of places in this fertile universe. pH, the acidity or alkalinity of a solution. Now, pH scale is a logarithmic scale, like the Richter scale. So that means that as you go from pH 7 to pH 6, it's 10 times more acidic. And pH 6 to pH 5, 10 times more acidic. So this is, in fact, an enormous range. The ocean's about pH 8. Our cells are about pH 7. Yet we have found organisms down to pH 0 from multiple groups, pH 0. And I strongly suspect we're going to find them below pH 0. If you go home and take your chem book out, it turns out you can actually go below pH 0. We've also found organisms in places like the Rift Valley in Kenya and Tanzania up at pH 12. I mean, it's just phenomenal when you think about it. I would suspect there are organisms who could go above 12, but to find a habitat like that out in the natural world so far is unknown. So what else could you throw at an organism? Well, desiccation. We use water as a solvent. We depend absolutely on water. So if you lose the water, there's going to be a limit to life. And yet we have organisms that we think can live on water vapor. We certainly know there are even mammals like camels that can live with lower quantities of water. There are organisms that can produce spores where they get rid of much of their body water. There are little animals called tardigrades, water bears, that can get rid of much of the water in their body and go into a dormant state. But they can't stay active in this desiccated state. So we do need water at some point. Salinity, too much salt, is going to stop life. And if you stop for a moment, think about all these environmental parameters that I'm pointing out, these run absolutely parallel to the history of food preservation. We use high temperature, low pH for sauerkraut, high pH. We use salinity, we use salt to preserve meats and so on, because we know that there's a limit to life in high salt. Yet we have found organisms that are able to at least survive in solid salt. Chemical extremes are extremes of arsenic, CO2, mercury, and so on, that would be horrific to any of us, and yet there are organisms that can survive there. Pressure. There are organisms that have been taken up from the bottom of the ocean. Some of them get to the surface and explode. Some of them are perfectly happy at the surface as well. Similarly, as you go up and you decrease the pressure, there's some organisms that are going to be able to make it and some that aren't. We don't have this really well constrained. Radiation, this is closer to my own field of research. Solar radiation creates enormous problems for biomolecules. It can break the DNA backbone. It can cause havoc in nucleic acids, proteins, lipids, you name it. And so too much solar radiation, as we know, just even going outside in the summer, is going to create a really bad problem. Now imagine you're up above our ozone layer, it's that much worse. And on the early Earth before there was an ozone layer, it must have been horrific. Oxygen, oxidative damage, is incredibly nasty. We don't think about this because we're sitting in a room that's about 20% oxygen or so. But in fact, organisms that use oxygen like we do are literally playing with fire. Oxygen's not so bad, water's not so bad, but it's all these radicals in the middle that can be really nasty and once again do a job on your lipids, your proteins, your nucleic acids, and so on. So in that respect, we're extremophiles as well. And finally, I put in electricity there just simply because I wouldn't want to swim with an electric eel, but, you know, whatever. Okay, so why are there these limits to life? Well, let's go back a step again. Because organisms don't just need carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur, and water, and so on. They need a body. They need a physical presence. So they need to keep their bodies intact, and many of these environmental extremes won't allow that. They need to be able to survive long enough to have offspring, and there needs to be some sort of continuity between the generations. So could it happen again? Well, there are a couple of ways that we can argue this. One is from convergence. And what we're looking at here is examples of organisms that have evolved a thorn to protect themselves. Everything from a cactus to a rose, whistling acacia at the bottom, and the top middle, that's a real close-up of a porcupine. All of these organisms have independently evolved the same solution to the problem. So when you look around the natural world and you see multiple examples of convergence where multiple organisms from different taxa have evolved the same solution to the same problem, it gives one some confidence that maybe in an evolutionary sense this is not too difficult. So you've got an argument for convergence, and then you have strong selective pressure. As I mentioned, that argument before about a pressure for photosynthesis, then herbivory and carnivory. So what I'm suggesting is that there's a limit to the fertility of the universe because we need the certain building blocks, but more than that, we need to have them within certain environmental constraints. We have absolutely no idea what it takes to originate life, but that may be very different from the environment that we need for the continuity of life. So if we look even in our own neighborhood, we've got the bare bones requirements in a couple of places, possibly in the clouds of Venus, certainly Venus before it went into a runaway greenhouse billions of years ago may have had exactly the same conditions as were on Earth, and life arose on Earth, we know that. Mars, similar sort of situation, and we haven't given up the thought that there could conceivably still be life on Mars. Europa, one of these little moons of Jupiter, we know that it's got an ice-covered ocean. There's certainly analogous places on Earth, like ice-covered lakes in the Antarctic, and we know that there is a very active biosphere beneath these ice-covered lakes. We know, or we think, that are the organic compounds on Europa, so you've got the liquid water and the organic compounds, ice-covered lake, at least it's a possibility. Similar situation with Enceladus, which is a little moon of Saturn. Titan, which was mentioned earlier, is a completely different story. This is another moon of Saturn, but in this case, it's sort of a frozen chemistry experiment. It's bitterly cold, and so the liquid solvent there, compounds like methane, the water there is what forms the rocks. So it's got the building blocks, but at a grossly different temperature than we're used to. So if there's going to be a very different kind of life using a different solvent, Titan might be a great place to look. There is some thought that there is liquid water perhaps beneath the surface of Titan, and then it becomes even more interesting in terms of a life more like our own. What about beyond? As Father Coyne mentioned, that there are many, many extrasolar planets that are being discovered at an increasingly rapid rate. We've got missions that are going to be coming up in the very, very soon, like Kepler, where we're going to really be able to look for terrestrial Earth-like planets and expand our knowledge. But it certainly looks like there are literally billions and billions of other Earth-like planets. And in addition to that, as I just mentioned, there are moons that are possibilities. So you throw that in, and you have to think that there are lots and lots of places that probably at least have the building blocks. But again, we have this gap of what does it take to actually form life. So again, it's easy to talk about the prerequisites for life. It's easy to talk about the evolution of life. What's not so easy is to talk about the origin of life. And I'm just going to finish by demonstrating how difficult it is. Here are two hypotheses that we can't necessarily distinguish between. From just going in a simple step from a prebiotic to the sort of world that we live in now, the current thought is that we used RNA as a genetic material before we ended up in a world like ours based on DNA. Now, DNA is much more stable than RNA. Proteins are much better enzymes, so it would make sense to go to a world from RNA, which has the capability to have genetic information as well as have enzymatic information, to a DNA protein world. But we don't know for sure. This is just a hypothesis. We also have hypotheses going from a world where there might have been genetic material to a situation that we have today where we have individual organisms. We don't think about that much, but the origin of individuality must have been an absolutely crucial step in the origin of life. And that we don't know for sure either. We think that there may have been a stage where genetic material was freely passed around, and at some point it became much more rigid, so you had inheritance in a linear parent-child sort of situation. So what I'd like to do is finish by giving this view of life, which is a little different than the view that was given before. And what I'm going to do is quote from the last paragraph of that marvelous book. Of course, I'm referring to The Origin of Species. And read here, it is interesting, this is in Darwin's words, which I think are an incredibly poetic view of life. It is interesting to contemplate an entangled bank clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have been produced by laws acting around us. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Now, what we're saying is there is grandeur in this view of life, but how much more wonderful if this view of life extends elsewhere in our universe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There's some really cool questions here, and they're kind of hard, too. Let me start on a couple of these that I find kind of interesting. Any comments on so-called outside-of-the-box hypothesis for intelligent life or any life abode? And there are two mentioned. One is Fred Hoyle's, black interstellar clouds. Another one is Robert Forward's On the Surface of a Neutron Star. Do you have any comments on that, either of you?
I've been talking about George.
My general comment would be it's interesting science fiction. I don't know what else to say to it than that. I think it really leans out very far beyond what we know. And that's why I call it fiction. I don't think it's based upon our true knowledge of neutron stars. I think the black cloud work of Fred Hoyle, story of Fred Hoyle, is a very interesting one. But I don't think there, despite the fact that he's an eminent scientist, of course, that there's much science in it. That's my only comment, Pete. I don't know if other scientists... I mean, we should have the audience also, who sometimes are more knowledgeable, in fact, many times more knowledgeable than the speakers on.
Okay. Well, let me ask a kind of a related question, and I've got a couple here, but if we're so smart, why have we so far been unable to produce in the lab or life in the lab, starting with a pile of chemicals, and noting that the 1953 Miller-Urey experiment was interesting, but no cigar. And so can we trigger the conditions for life?
First of all, we don't know for a fact that no one's made life. It just hasn't been published. We certainly know that there are plenty of people working on it from the point of view of either the genetic material or from lipid vesicles. Our good friend and colleague Dave Diemer down at Santa Cruz has done some marvelous work over the years making lipid vesicles and then putting molecules in it to try to start to get active cells. I also know that there are companies working on it, pretty much under lock and key. So we are not aware of anyone creating life. If we're so smart, how come we haven't been working on it very long is one answer. But what bothers me actually more is that even if we were able to create life, and, again, it turns out that it was done tonight while other people were in their labs and we were here enjoying ourselves, that doesn't mean it's how it arose on planet Earth or elsewhere. That is something that it's difficult enough to try it here, but unfortunately, I don't think we will ever know how it actually originated on Earth.
Okay. Got one for Father Coyne. This is an interesting one. I'd like to see the answer in this one. Imagine God granted to Galileo a tour of the Vatican Observatory today, and you were his guide. What would be the first thing you would say to him or show him?
Well, I'd show him his own book. I think is the first thing I'd do. Because we have a second edition of Galileo's Dialogue in which he has the beautiful drawing of the sun-centered universe, and it's very nicely done. I would then probably tell him that he shouldn't have been so arrogant. And I don't mean with respect to the church. I mean with respect to one of his scientific colleagues, namely Johann Kepler, who was the first to determine that the planets were going not in circular but in elliptical orbits using the observations of Tycho Brahe. The point I bring it up is that it's interesting. Galileo, besides the things we all know about him and his controversy with the church, there are a lot of things that are very interesting about Galileo that are not that praiseworthy of him. I mean, he cut off his correspondence with Kepler, as best I know, because he was kind of jealous. And he would never to the day of his death, would he accept elliptical orbits. It's a strange kind of thing because Galileo was the one who brought down Aristotelianism. Okay, what I mean by that is that Aristotle had this view of the heavenly bodies and the earthly bodies, and the heavenly bodies must all be perfect and circular, and they couldn't have any blotches on them. Okay, Galileo destroyed that Aristotelian concept because he observed spots on the moon, mountains and valleys, spots on the sun, mountains and valleys on the moon. They were not perfect bodies, but he would not accept. He held on to that ancient kind of Greek prejudice that these objects had to go in circular orbits. And so he refused to, he cut off his correspondence with Kepler. So I would do two things, show him his own great book and praise him for it, and then say he shouldn't have been as arrogant as he was. But there are other things that...
Why don't you get his autograph while he's there?
He probably would have asked for mine. Isn't that terrible?
This is a good follow-up question for both of you. As people who have taken on popular stances in their respective vocations, what's the role of the dissenter in scientific discovery, and what is the role of the community in squashing the illogical, whether it's little green men or intelligent design?
I'm not sure I agree with the premise to that question. I know there are some who say you should question everything, and I'm hesitant to say that. I think if you spend your life questioning gravity and, questioning a lot of other things, you're wasting your time. You have to find those areas that really need to be questioned, and because you have fresh data, because you have a fresh insight, and then you need to go for them, and you just have to at some point have faith that you're doing the right thing. I know my hero Darwin definitely had those days that he felt that he, you know, he could see in a way that no one else on earth could, and the next day, probably mostly after he got lousy reviews of his books, said, "Oh, I'm just terrible. Why am I doing this? You know, I should just be sitting here playing backgammon with my wife." I'm paraphrasing, of course. But, I mean, you know, everyone has their doubts, but if you really feel that there's an area that needs to be explored, you've got to just have that drive and commitment to do it. George?
I would say, yeah, no, I agree with you, Lynn. I would only add that there is an element of faith to doing science, okay? I did not measure the age of the universe. And yet, I trust that the age of the I accept that the age of the universe is 13.7 billion years. I did not measure the velocity of light or the mass of the proton. But when I do my science, I accept what is in the books about those. So there is a certain, from what Lynn is saying, you can't question everything or you'll never do anything. You have to accept what has been done. The other issue, however, is a very interesting one. And I always, when I start saying to my class, you know, most scientists would agree that, then I look at myself and I say, the truth is not democratic. The truth is true or not, regardless of how many scientists think it's true. So there's that element of being skeptical. So it's an interplay of being skeptical, but you can't do anything if you're skeptical about everything.
For the last question here, I've had a couple questions here, maybe just to quickly comment on, are there any clues in biogenics or God or anything else, or what existed before the Big Bang, the T-minus first second?
Oh, this, I always have fun with this one. First of all, the real answer is, there is no before the Big Bang. Space and time are parameters of the universe. So time began with the Big Bang. So it makes no sense to talk before because there was no time. The same with the expansion of the universe. People say, what is it expanding into? It's creating space, if you want, as it expands, because space and time are intrinsic properties of the universe. St. Augustine, though, I always like to tell this story because it's true. St. Augustine, in the 3rd century, 4th century, had studied, not so much scientifically, but he studied the notion of time as a measure of a periodic motion, a pendulum or the earth going about the sun or whatever, a periodic motion. So he knew his real answer to one who asked him, what was God doing before he created the universe? They put it in a religious context. He knew the answer. There was no before God created the universe. There was no before. There was no time. But Augustine liked to tell them, he said, what was God doing before he created the universe? He was creating hell for people that ask questions like that.
Okay. I guess that tells me what's happening to former students. Well, I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Yale Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Lynn Rushfield, research scientist at NASA Ames Research Center, and Father George Coyne, astronomer and director emeritus of the Vatican Observatory, our audience here at NASA Ames, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.